Anyway, I think that I'm ready to roll, so if the tape would begin to roll, I'll begin. I'm Darlene Johnson, and the ELCIC behind my name, it stands for Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada. It was because I'm ahead of time, okay. I'll wait for the tape to go again.
Being taped?
All the lectures are taped.
Oh.
All the sessions
are taped. They want session.
Okay, hopefully the tape is rolling now. Darlene Johnson from the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada. And my topic is global perspectives on issues facing women. Or maybe a subtitle would be a report on a seminar called Women and Development, Crisis and Alternative Visions. I am a participant. I am a guest in the village. Normally I'm sitting in the chairs where you're sitting. So I'm feeling a little bit uncomfortable in the hot seat. But last month, for the first 2 weeks of June, I was in a village at the Ecumenical Institute near Geneva, Switzerland, at this seminar, Women and Development. I was chosen to go as a representative of our church, and that's why I put the ELCIC up there. In our church, I have no official capacity, I'm not paid by the church for anything, but I have been a social ministry facilitator within our synod, and at present I coordinate the social ministry facilitator project. And it's where we try to get volunteers or people who get very small honorariums to work with congregations in dealing with social ministry concerns, including world development issues. My own experience has taken me into the third world, and so I'm maybe more knowledgeable than some of the social ministry facilitators in my synod, in the sense of to know, to have actually experienced, to have learned about development from being there. So it was a real privilege for me to be chosen to go, and the event itself was organized by the World Council of Churches Women's Desk in conjunction with the Lutheran World Federation Women's Desk. We were 48 participants from 26 countries representing all regions of the world. We worked in four languages, English, Spanish, French, and German. Of the, did I say 47? 48 participants, 47 women, one man. So he came from India and sometimes he got jumped on. You might understand, you know, if you think about the relationship between men and women in India, you might understand why he would get jumped on quite frequently. But our task was to consider gender analysis as a key to alternative visions to development, to affirm alternatives to the present development models that are in place around the world, which are making life increasingly difficult for women. To formulate strategies which might strengthen women's participation in decision-making and leadership. So I knew that we had these tasks before I went, and coming as a North American, I wasn't quite sure where I fit into the scheme, but having worked in a third world country, I was hoping that just, you know, another head would add, you know, two heads are better than one, that the creativity would come out of the diversity of the various regions. I tried to sit back and really listen a lot, and but we worked in small groups, we worked in plenary, and so there was opportunity for everybody to be a part of what was going on. We began the whole session by trying to define what development should be. And if we had more time here, I'd like to, you know, kind of have you do that same exercise, but we had 10 days in Switzerland and just 1 hour here. But when you think about development, we talk about development in so many different ways. We talk about physical and emotional development that people go through personally. But in this context, we were talking about development in more of the world development context. And so it tends to have an economic base, but what more than economics is development? We broke into small groups to work on this, and so that everyone could have their say in it. And the particular group that I was in came up with the definition that development is a continuous process of transformation of personal and community life, consisting of social, economic, spiritual, cultural, ecological, physical, and psychological dimensions, enhancing security, justice, and peace, and transcending age and gender barriers. I don't know how we got it all in one sentence. I'm a very skilled person putting it all together. But we also recognize that there are two inherent problems accompanying any kind of development that would, there are always conflicting interests, and also with development, new challenges, or maybe, quote, problems, will arise. Anyway, so we came back to the group with this definition, and other, you know, the other groups came back with their definitions, some less concise, some slightly different tangents, but all of the groups recognized that development is a process, that it allows all people to realize full potential, that it is not exploitive of natural resources, and that it creates justice rather than injustice. And we were very aware that we were meeting at the same time as the United Nations Conference on Environment in Rio, and so this was, it was always being brought to our attention. We were talking about development that would make the world a better place for women and children, but would not be exploitive of nature. We had guests or participants, we sort of really mixed, but participants from Australia, Chile, and Kenya brought case studies of alternative kind of development projects that they're working on. So we looked at those first. The woman from Australia was working in a housing project for low economic women, and she's an accountant herself, and she was helping them to develop what she called micro-industry, work that employed one or two persons, and found that it was allowing the women in the housing project to get off welfare and have enough income to support their families. And that the kinds of jobs that they came up with were very creative and very satisfying to them, and immediately raised people's self-esteem and help with the family problems that occur when people are forced to take their support from the state. The participant from Chile talked about her work with a primary health group. And they're working with training people to do basic nursing and doctoring in isolated areas where there is no hospital around. Kenya, the person from Kenya talked about work that she was doing with women farmers. In Africa, most women are farmers, and they provide most of the food that's eaten in Africa, and often don't get a lot of credit for it. But the work that she was doing was a women's farm project. So they were projects that are outside of the mainstream, but they all improve the lives of women, and which allows them to improve the lives of their families. We looked, those were kind of the economic examples of development, or how it affected women's lives economically. And then other case studies that were looked at were issues that were more than economics. We had Mary Pellauer from the Lutheran the Commission on Women in the ELCA speak on violence against women. We had a woman from the Philippines talking about her work with human rights problems. She's been an activist for many years and has worked with land rights. And in that time, she's been jailed on several occasions, held 2 years without charges. So she, from personal experience, a young woman knows about human rights violations, and now she's in that field, working with that field. the person from Brazil brought us, talked about a group in northeastern Brazil where they're working, it's a popular movement working towards unionization. She brought a particular example, she had some slides of women, mostly women, who are employed in coconut husking, and this is their job, but how difficult the situation is for them and how they unionize, in a sense, you know, how there's power in being together. So, and as well as that, one of the participants was from East Germany, and her work is with refugees in Berlin, mostly refugees from Eastern Europe. And she continually reminded us of how our Western-style development that we tend to take and impose to countries we call third world or in, you know, in need of our vision, how much it dominates the lives of those who have lived under the socialist system. It doesn't, at the moment, it doesn't give the people a chance to catch up. It doesn't allow them to look back and consider the what they have valued, what has been their tradition. And they're just being forced into this Western style that they're not prepared for. And it's creating a lot of dislocation, especially amongst women who are the first to lose their jobs, and creating economic refugees. Then two of the speakers helped us to evaluate the traditional approaches to development that have been taken by aid agencies. I'm sure that we in North America have all been generous in supporting aid agencies that dig wells or set up farming cooperatives or crafts manufacturing or, you know, whatever. What's been discovered is that for all the money given in aid, women's positions seem to be deteriorating. And the question is why? Aid agencies have been looking at this recently, and the first, you know, when they first noticed it, they began targeting women's projects. It was called the Women in Development approach. So that, you know, if you're being solicited for money to an aid agency, you're probably being told about all these women's projects. Here's a shelter for women, or here's a what's from Bangladesh creating jute angels, or, you know, whatever. The women in development approach tends to see that women are the problem, you know, here's a problem in development. These women are living very poorly, and we need to improve their lot. So projects are set up for them. Well, after doing that for a few years, aid agencies are seeing that that's not really working either. So now the new strategy is to take and look at the whole situation in terms of gender analysis. What are the social roles of, you know, with men and women, and who makes the decisions, and, you know, how is it affecting the whole family? And so from that, when they do gender, what they call gender analysis development, they study the whole social situation and how a project might affect every group. So hopefully women will be, the projects will address where women are in the power structure. And what the aid agencies are now saying is that they won't, or they try not to support projects where women have had no part in the planning or will have no part in the implementation. So that hopefully there'll be better results. It will remain to be seen, but a lot of education is going on around this to empower women so that they get more benefit out of projects that are started. In discussing the present model of development being followed by both the North and the South, you know, a kind of a capitalistic development, isn't it, that we rely on producing goods to create money to bring into our families to support ourselves and meet our needs. That model is being pursued all around the world. It's being forced on a lot of places by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. Looking at that model, we recognize that the present system exploits both the people and especially nature. I just tore something out of a our local magazine about the Rio Summit, and so I keep looking at it here, but the following problems are obvious. Profit as the main concern is neither is based on free market or free trade principles, but the market isn't free and it isn't fair. So the weak and the small lose out to the strong and the big. And I'm sure that you can recognize that here at home, as we do in Canada. We have just gone through this free trade agreement with the United States, and in Canada we feel that we're losing a lot of industry to the United States, and our employment increases. Now, both of our countries are dealing with a free trade agreement with Mexico. And what's that going to do? And I know that a lot of you are concerned about how it's going to affect employment in America. And I realize that a lot of you who live in the north of America have already watched industry move to the south. So, it, you know, the whole thing moves from small and many to large and few, as economics is the, you know, the profit motive is the major motive. Also related to this, aid that comes, well, maybe not even related to this, but aid, when we see the discrepancies and we give aid from the north, it tends to have conditions put on it, and these conditions create outside control for the south. So it strengthens the control and exploitation of the south by the north. And we have strings attached to our aid. Another problem is that nature becomes marginalized. It's based on the thinking that nature is a non-living thing, a resource to be used, a constant supplier of raw materials, and an absorber of waste. Nature will regenerate itself. Nature has been plundered. Also, this model marginalizes and disempowers women. Many women have no access to land or property. In, you know, as we heard the stories from various countries around the world, it's quite appalling. We live with more opportunity, although more opportunity legally, but how many women really have funds to own a lot of property? You know, so the balance isn't equitable, even in Western world or the quote North. But anyway, in many countries, women just don't have that opportunity. In Kenya, for instance, a woman has the legal right to own property, but if she is married and her husband has debts, her property will be sold to pay for her husband's debts. So she doesn't really own it. Increasingly, women have lost control over any decision-making and power which they might have had in their traditional structures. And that often comes in by our aid, you know, our aid agencies or the stipulations we in the north put on the aid that goes to the south. Introduction of cash crops, such as sugar or coffee, instead of food crops means that the money out of them goes to the men, and men don't necessarily feel the responsibility to support the families with that. So that cash often does not feed the family. We saw an excellent video at the event. It was produced by New Internationalist, and it showed about farming in Africa. Women produce 80% of the food that Africa eats. But the problem is that women are more and more marginalized from the land on which they can produce their food, and also the expectations, their labor is exploited more and more. They have less time to produce food for their families because the expectation is that they will also work on the cash crop. Women are the weeders. They are the planters and the weeders. If it's a big operation, they may use some technology to do the planting, the plowing and the planting. But women will have to do the weeding. And so they'll spend hours on a cash crop plot and then not have the time to work on a family food plot. And just the balance of power and the division of labor in Africa doesn't allow for the men to take over the family food plot. So it just is, there's less and less time and energy and space for producing family food. And the cash crops go to the industrialized world.
I don't understand. If the men are not Can you see that working in the field? Or, I mean, that's just women's work.
That's women's work.
Okay.
They will operate the machines in on the big plot for sugar, or but they wouldn't take the hoe and weed it. Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't do the just a small plot. They wouldn't plow the ground for a small plot.
Even if it meant keeping them starvation.
It was quite. It's not every man, obviously, but it's the tendency. And in the video, it was very obvious. It was a man from a Western African country watching his wives. He had many wives, and you know they were really struggling to produce the food for the family. And they were struggling, especially because one wife had just had a baby, and so their custom protects the new mother and the baby by keeping her out of the labor for out of the. You know, she can't go out of her home for a week to allow her to regain strength and to establish the baby. Well, with her not able to work in the family system, it just meant so much more work for the other wives. And the man is standing and he's interviewed and he says, well, I know I could help with the field, but it isn't done. So he was very honest about it. But, and also, with family interests, you know, the women are the nurturers and they're the ones most concerned about it. But when you have the problems that have been, the monetary problems of the third world, there's so much debt. And with the structural adjustment policies that are being imposed on these countries, it requires cutbacks in health, education, water, and housing expenditures, which negatively affect the women and the children the most. Often the men are away from the family. They are sort of breadwinners, but they're not in the community where the family is. They are off in a city. And soon the family breaks down because the money doesn't come back. There's not enough communication between them. And it was really quite horrifying to realize how few marriages are intact, how few families actually live together in third world countries. Also, another problem with the development at present is that as people and resources are controlled, militarization is institutionalized. So we've seen the growth of armies, police, and weapons all around, all over the world. And while 60% of the world's population lives in extreme poverty, $2 million is spent on weapons every minute. Also, development has led to homogenization, which reduces diversity. And that was one of the real concerns at the Rio event too. But in the past, in a different sense, in the economic sense, in the past, lots of people made small profits and lived simply. But now everything is based on this profit and growth, and so you have the larger manufacturing economy being built up. You have large textile mills, large electronics firms moving into these third world countries or other industries like that, and along with the agribusiness, and that displaces many ordinary people. The move is from small and many to large and few, and the kind of work that they do is less and less creative. It becomes more assembly line, so more and more mindless, less creative. You lose that creativity. As well, the process of homogenization implies that what has been the industry or the agriculture or the medical, you know, the medicine or the science of the third world groups or of indigenous peoples or even of women's culture is considered to be not efficient, not scientific, not good. We label it backward. And we have to have this Western idea of scientific progress. The culture of the powerful is imposed on the others. As well, this system is unsustainable because there are just no resources on planet Earth to give everybody the standard of consumption that we in the industrialized countries live by. So the alternative to development must have the following elements. It has to be in harmony with nature. It has to be people-centered, where people are the subjects and not the objects. It should be women-centered, because right now, although women are the poorest and the most vulnerable, they really are the ones taking care of the basic needs of humanity. We are the reproducers. Across the world, basically, we are the nurturers. In most parts of the world, we are the ones that provide the food. In most parts of the world, also the fodder for the animals, the fuel for the home, and basically supplying the shelter. In our countries, we don't build the shelter, but we tend to be the ones who make it homey and comfortable and are responsible for that. Most of that is not ever noticed in GNP. Women's work is not considered work, you know, in a gross national product sense. So it's just discounted. But for these reasons, women must be at the center of sustainable development. And women are more likely to insist on the basics being supplied rather and that killings and violence be stopped. So when women get a little more power, hopefully there's a shift away from the militarization aspect. Also, development needs to be needs-oriented, meaning sustenance for all rather than big profits for a few and squandering the limited resources of the earth. Should be decentralized and democratic, where we don't have a rich country telling a poor country what to do, or we don't have a central government telling every little community what they have to do. There has to be a grassroots democracy where people can make decisions for themselves about how they're going to live. Anyway, after we talked about development like this, we had the final part of our session was to come up with some strategies on women's issues. And so we moved then into, you know, what are the issues that are really affecting women? And I'd be curious to see what you think are issues facing women.
Birth control, prenatal care. Two basic ones. Child care.
Mm-hmm. Division of labor between spouses within the homes. Mm-hmm. For the African women, I think that must be very important. Recognition as full human beings.
Mm-hmm. I think in many parts of the world, health care is a real issue both for women and children.
Okay, so your basic health care and the power divisions. When we got together in small groups to try and determine which were the issues we were going to deal with specifically to try and find strategy, some things came up over and over and over again. So in the end, we narrowed ourselves to four issue groups. Five groups actually, but four issues. Some were interested in the whole theory of gender analysis that underlies power structures in the world. So that became one issue group. The violence against women was a concern right across the board. I had come to that event expecting my own background. It's an issue, it's something that I work in, at least violence against children and adolescent women. But so I had come thinking this was maybe more of a North American problem, that first you look after the basic food and health issues, and then when those are looked after, you can start dealing with family issues. But it wasn't like that. Everyone had the concern of violence against women. So that was our second one. The whole the division of resources was of a concern because that relates to basic health and food and having enough to eat concerns. So division, the redistribution of resources and power, because power affects how those resources are used. So that became another group, redistribution of resources and power. And the last group was the empowerment of women. How to get women into leadership positions where they can make their own decisions about how things will be. And two groups worked on that because there were so many concerned about it. It might have had something to do with the fact that everybody there was in some way responsible for a women's program. You know, you want to bring women on side and help them to go out and do things for themselves. But issues that we really worked on and came up with strategies at the end. And I could go on about what strategies we have, but maybe I'd rather have you ask questions than read it all off. I have our original papers that from each of the groups. So if anyone wants to look at them in detail, they can. And I have them summarized as well.
Could you run by your definition of development one more time? Groups from the first page.
Do you want me to give our specific one or the one that they all sort of
developed? Yeah, the one.
We all came up with the idea that development is a process, that it allows all people to realize full potential, that it is not exploitive of natural resources, and it creates justice rather than injustice. The group that I worked in was the Violence Against Women, because my own background, I work with a volunteer program where we educate high school students against child abuse and dating violence. So I thought I had a little bit of an area of expertise, so I went into that group. Mary Pellauer was in it as well, and she had brought several resources. This one, though, I found really interesting, Gender Violence, a Development in Human Rights Issue by Charlotte Bunch and Roxana Carrillo. It was really good. It relates much more to more than the interpersonal relationships. It looks at the whole issue of development and how gender violence affects that. And then this one I just brought along, if you've been sexually abused or harassed, you know, how to get help in the ELCA. But we went through, you know, we were, as issue groups, we were charged to come up with some strategies. So we went through trying to think of some strategies that would help women educationally, legally, in the community. And as well, we defined abuse quite clearly, as I would do in the classroom, and then gave some, you know, what do you do if you know that someone's been abused. In our group, it was obvious that it was a real concern because everyone was sharing about their own personal experience of violence or a very close personal friend, relative. So.
I have a question. With all of these women together from all over the world, I guess it has to do with culture and how so much of imbalance of power and even violence is just inbred in culture.
Mm-hmm.
Who teaches culture? You know, we as women can try, you know, the hand that rocks the cradle, we still traditionally rock the cradle, you know, try to teach that, but it's just so hard. You know, when our children become exposed, just generally, you know, I have my little three-year-old coming home and saying, pink is the color for girls and blue is the color for boys. And I say, oh no. I mean, it starts so young.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as my husband and I have tried to teach him, we see these things just coming in from everywhere. And that, to me, seems a basis. We almost have to have a coup d'etat on culture in every country in the world in order to make a change.
That was particularly obvious in the small group that I was working in Violence Against Women, when we talked with a woman from India. You know, the problems are so great because the culture is so oppressive of the women in India, and they are so unvalued as persons. I don't know how many of you are aware, but the practice of selective abortion is common in India, as well as femicide, of letting, well, either killing a newborn female or just allowing that newborn to die by active neglect. I think it was the World Health Organization has studied what the ratio of male-female births is naturally, and taking what would be normal in Africa and transplanting that into India, they say that 30 million women are short in India.
You know what that's going to do.
Well, one day it's going to, I said,
yeah,
you know,
at
some point it's going to, the population will not, you know, there won't be enough women to go around for reproductive purposes.
Right.
But the woman who was in our group said, oh no, there are too many women in India. So, I don't know. But they are not valued. A woman is such a liability to a family. A father pays to get rid of his daughter. And then you have all these bride burnings because he didn't pay enough, and the husband's family hasn't found that she is worthwhile or worthy enough.
How much does education affect that? I have to admit, my only friend who's from India came to this country and got the doctorate, and she was from a rather wealthy family that was, actually I think she had only sisters in her family, and there were about six or seven of them. Her father was a police chief of the area they lived in. And they're also Lutheran, and they were Christians. I just wondered, how much does an educated person see the culture differently? And how much opportunity is there for education for women in this country?
Well, certainly this particular woman was a Lutheran Christian as well. And she was talking about, and she works in educating women. Now, she never fessed up whether she had been part of a marriage arrangement that her father had to pay for. However, she did talk about how difficult it is to talk about these issues even within the family. It's just not the thing to do. The mother does not, there's very minimal sexual education for girls by their mother. And the mother would never talk to her son. Like, that's just not.
Well, and also, in this family, it wasn't arranged marriage. They knew the early age they would be marrying each other. And of course, the woman who marries the man goes directly into his mother's household.
Which sets up for a lot of interfamily.
And I just wonder how many of us would like to live with their mother. And actually, the mother-in-law ends up raising the children in some cases, and has a very big influence. Then I'm wondering if that mother obviously has sons. I wonder what her participation was in maybe not having daughters. And are women participating at that site?
Oh yes. And women are participating in killing themselves off rather than be. If you have been sexually abused or raped as an Indian woman, it's better to die. You will kill yourself. You have no life after that. A widow has no life. She has been sexually used. So women almost never remarry in India.
Also, women who are like the woman who was the head of a household for a new bride comes in, is many times very cruel to the new bride because you have to pay your dues like I paid my dues.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's really all just a form of self-hate, that gets perpetuated. And, we have a lot of that in North America. It's just, it's very difficult. And how much, like, this was an educated woman, obviously, the woman, is quite educated. How much, if they can't talk about it, how can you change culture? Perhaps by example, but it would feel like that would be one small island that would just be eaten up, because as soon as you send your daughter to live in the other household, yikes, got to wait a whole generation to raise the grandchildren in order if you survive that long. You live that long. And that's just a frustration I guess I continually face. Living in California, we have multicultural and just so many cultures there. And I'm always, as a social worker, relating, to women and trying to be culturally sensitive. And yet at the same time, in my mind, I'm thinking, if you were not a slave to this culture, you could just burst out of this and be free of it. And yet, that feels so judgmental to me. I mean, I'm always just struggling back and forth with that.
That's very hard to look at it, it isn't hard to, but I mean, we need to be really sensitive about saying that everything about this culture is wrong. It's obviously survived for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. It's had some purpose. One wonders when education needs to change something.
Right, and I don't think everything about every culture is wrong, but to look at yourself as damaged goods because you've been abused sexually, which was no choice of your own, that's wrong. That's not how God looks at us.
But that's not too far back in our own culture.
Exactly.
if it has been erased at this point.
Yeah, present. Look at Anita Hill. I mean,
yeah.
You know, and a panel of men judging her. Men who we know their backgrounds are, you know, lily white pure. And, you know, that kind of thing. It's just very hard.
My daughter-in-law chose to leave her culture because she wanted different choices for herself. More non-abusive type choices. And the price she's paying then is to be entirely cut off from her whole family. That's a fairly high price for a young person to pay. Although she chose to pay it, it is very high price.
Mm-hmm. But something that you alluded to came up time and again, that we as women, we begin the cultural process. Mm-hmm. So we as women have to start with our own children to do some questioning. In the group that looked at gender sensitivity and gender relations, one of the things it was theoretical, but you have to raise questions. Raising questions is where you start. And if we are Christians, we start raising questions in our theological analysis. But I think, Jennifer, was it you that mentioned the other, no. Somebody mentioned the other day about, was it you? Whose daughter is just convinced that God is a man. And though we would not want our children to believe that, they're picking it up from somewhere else. And
that's an argument.
Can I share something? My sister married a man from a Jewish background who is a practicing Jew, and she's chosen to kind of stay out of organized religion herself. But as she was reading some Bible stories to her daughter, who was only 3, I think it was Noah's Ark or some story like that, she asked a question about God, and her mom answered something, and then Rachel said, "Well, why did she do that?" And when they came to visit our church, she wanted to see God. She wanted to know if God was going to be there. Well, I'm sure God would be there, but, you know, it would be a little hard to see God because God was in everybody and all around. Very hard to explain to a 3-year-old. But it was interesting as several different men got up to share some different things in the front, and she wasn't impressed at all. I mean, she was waiting to see God. She was real disappointed she never got to that point in the service. She never did see God. So maybe, untouched, uninfluenced by the church, our children might have a different vision of God. It really was an eye-opener for me because this little child, totally innocent, and making her own assumptions because no one has put other assumptions into her mind.
Yeah, my particular church is PCUSA, and our assumption is that people of all races and of both genders are made in the image of God. And that's what I teach my son. I teach my son that God does not have a gender and does not have a race.
What's your church? I didn't hear you.
Presbyterian Church USA. PCUSA.
You know, I just want to interject something. You said that God does not have a gender and he does not have a race. I think I heard you say he, and this is the same thing. I heard it too when I do this, get into these theological discussions with my 13-year-old. You know, the profound element of how gender creeps in by need to simplify by using pronouns and then the traditional use of he.
Yeah, because we don't have the right pronoun for the general. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. So those things do.
We're not comfortable with it for a person.
So one has to go back to the noun itself. God does not have a gender. God does not have a race.
It's so important. I think community, though, also is important, as we see up here. You know, and if we keep our child from church, that's our traditional chosen community, you know, when we're absent from family, you know. And yet in community we need to learn that people have different opinions or ways or whatever, and you know, sort of our extended family, I guess, sometimes our churches are in some ways. And as within our own natural families, we may not agree with Uncle so-and-so or Aunt so-and-so, but you know what, that's how they are. And we look at it this different way. And it's real hard. We can't protect our kids. I'm learning that day by day. We just can't protect them, but we can be there to help educate them in the way that we feel or we have found is the correct way or more open way or something like that. It's just such a hard responsibility sometimes, I think, as a woman. I feel like it just falls right
off. Well, yeah, how many of our husbands or spouses or fathers take the responsibility to do this gender work with our children? You know, how many are really actively nurturing the children? You know, some of us have very supportive spouses mm-hmm. or parents, and some do not.
So I wanted to ask you, across the board, with incest as much a problem as we're now aware of it in this country, in this area, and with Canada?
I think the North Americans were more open to speaking about it, but from my expertise as a presenter, I know that incest is a big problem with quite a few different races. It's a big problem with Spanish people because the macho thing is there. The guy is supposed to have as many, but he's supposed to have as many people or women as he can, and he will often have his own daughters. But then she's supposed to be virginal, so it can't be vaginal sex. It has to be anal or oral. So, you know, and in the East Indian community, it's there too, but it's so disgraceful that the girl goes and commits suicide.
So if you're with this kind of, with the kinds of abuse and violence against children, what does that do to a person's self-esteem? It seems like it's such a secretive, it's such a hidden problem. So we want women to be empowered, but sometimes at the age of three, 4, 5 years old, they've been violated.
Mm-hmm.
How
and disempowered.
How can we, and then it isn't ever dealt with.
Well, that's why it was such a concern of the group. It came in from every country, every region of the world. Violence against women and children was a big issue. And we all realized that we have to take responsibility to, first of all, educate our children as young as possible on sexuality so that they know what would be incest or rape, or you know, they actually know the process and what should or should not be taking place. But also sexuality in the sense of the power relationships, because the other abuses are taking place because of power imbalances, emotional and physical abuse.
What I understand from incest victims is one of the key elements of that is that as children they don't understand boundaries very well.
Mm-hmm.
And so these people growing up being parents, and how do you teach boundaries if you don't really understand yourself very well? And oftentimes women end up in marriages that tend to reflect the same family they grew up in with the same kinds of abuses. And I would offer that this is not a women's issue, this is a men's issue.
That's why the program that I'm involved in goes into the high schools and talks to girls and boys together. We even go into all boys schools, so it's not just a female issue.
I mean, I don't know how you can talk about violence towards women without talking about the perpetrators of the violence towards women.
Yeah.
And what is happening? You know, how do you raise men that aren't violent towards women? And that maybe is the women's part of the issue if we are the nurturers.
I think in many of these countries, though, where the women who were there were working, that the violence against women issue has to be dealt with first in groups of women. To deal with the feelings and the problems that result from violence against women. To deal with immediate safety factors as well. But then once they feel secure in having a group, a supportive group to work within and have some sense of power has come back into their life, then you can start going out to the perpetrators and trying to change values that are endemic, you know, that are just there or in the power system. I mean, you know, think of Papua New Guinea and how prevalent violence against women is. How are you going to teach all those men that this isn't condonable? Well, first, I guess we've got to get women who are strong enough to say no, and if you are violent against me, I'm going to leave you.
Then where do they go to?
And then what do you go to? So that's where it's first a women's issue that you get them to recognize that this isn't something that I have to take, and if I don't want to take this, there is somewhere to go. That was in our strategies. We can't just say, well, we're going to stand up to this. We have to have shelters. We have to have nurturing groups that will believe and affirm and be there as safe places for the women who leave.
In some cultures, if a woman does stand up or helps another woman who has been violated, then the woman who has helped becomes the victim of her mm-hmm. male. Mm-hmm. And it just seems to be an unsolvable problem.
But you add to it, in our own culture, violence is entertainment. And then mm-hmm. how can we teach somebody that it's wrong when on TV in a commercial or a regular TV show, women are beat up constantly. Mm-hmm. Shot, people are shot. There's no value at all. Movies, TV. Mm-hmm.
Or the other women who are respected have automatic weapons in their hands.
Well, yeah. Exactly.
I live in a country where there is no violence, no kissing on TV, and there's a great deal of abuse. And women are definitely second class citizens.
Mm-hmm. Where is it?
That's where you're from. I live in Malaysia. There's no violence on TV. It's all censored. But
still exists.
It still exists.
Still exists.
And that's in the power structure.
It's not the media. It's the people. Mm-hmm. The culture.
Mm-hmm.
This went on long before TV. I mean, I feel that my mother was probably a parent because of her attitude towards men. Naturally, it was never mentioned. Mm-hmm. But looking back,
mm-hmm. You keep trying to put your hand up here.
Yeah. Again, on TV, when I could not sit down and watch a variety of shows, I found myself constantly telling him, you know, men of our family, don't do that to other people. Or, you know, if someone did that to you, how would you feel? If you did that to somebody, how would they feel about towards you? And I'll point out, you know, that's emotional abuse, that's verbal abuse, but it isn't, the emotional and verbal and physical abuse isn't always coming from men. Many times it comes from women characters, particularly emotional and verbal abuse. And I have basically wiped out the sitcoms and some of the other shows off the agenda because the sitcoms and the soap operas and such, there's a constant stream of verbal and emotional abuse, and I don't like to hear it. So I just take that off the agenda.
We tell our students that they receive 7,000 put downs per year in their teen years. That's kind of an average.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the other strategies for violence against women globally? To combat it.
See here. Well, first of all, that people should have a safe place to speak about their experience of abuse, because in many countries, even here, it's very difficult to come forward and talk about abuse. That there needs to be support and openness. Work for laws which do not further victimize those who have been abused. Work for inexpensive medical care available even in remote regions. Can you imagine being in an area without a hospital? What are you going to do if you are abused by your spouse or your son, whatever, or a stranger? With personnel who are trained to be sensitive to the needs of survivors. Provide basic education about physiology, sexuality, and reproduction. Protest forced sterilizations, which, by the way, is happening in many countries, especially Brazil was noted. You cannot get a job in Brazil unless you can produce the paper that you have been sterilized, because they don't want to pay for maternity leave. Or femicide, abortions of female fetuses. Attend to the spiritual and theological aspects of violence against women and children by reading the Bible through new and open eyes. Question doctrines which victimize women. Churches should implement, we were really thinking, you know, think about how we're taught how sin entered the world through a woman. You know, that's one to question. Churches should implement programs of education to prevent violence and provide support for those in need. A woman from Namibia talked about how her pastor takes groups at every different level. He'll speak to the young adults, he'll speak to the men of the congregation, the women of the congregation, and use those opportunities to provide education to prevent violence and provide support. All strategies that give women more economic resources should be supported, as lack of financial resources often keeps women trapped in violent relationships. Challenge societies which do not value women and children, and provide education about victimization. That was my summary of the report, but the report itself was 4 pages long, so.
Darlene, yes. What were some of the innovative ways the Australian women, what were some of the small industries that they began?
I don't know if I could recall any. Okay, they tended to do with more traditional things that women do, clothing for children or some kind of a service industry. But they picked up on the skills that people do as, quote, hobbies, and allowed them to develop it into something marketable.
It would need very little training. Mm-hmm.
But the women planned and implemented it, that's why it was successful?
Yeah.
Doing like a house cleaning business?
Yes, yeah, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And depending on what the hobbies and the skills of the person were. Mm-hmm. Well, is it time? Or do you have some more questions? Or?
Did you come away with any hope?
You know, I really did. I felt that was such an affirming seminar. That people all over the world are looking at the issues and are working in the places where they live. I really did find it was affirming. Is that the Ecumenical Institute Chateau de Bosse? Yeah, it was a chateau, it was lovely.